Hello and welcome to Behind the Headlines from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard statewide on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today, a Utah lawmaker introduces a bill to ban abortions after 15 weeks. The closure of the Road Home homeless shelter gets delayed, and celebrities and filmmakers descend on Utah as the 2019 Sundance Film Festival gets underway. In studio for this conversation, we have this morning Salt Lake Tribune editor Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Thank you for being here today, Jen.
Good morning, Roger.
Good morning. Reporter Bethany Rogers, good morning and welcome to you, Bethany.
Good morning.
And reporter Taylor Stevens, thank you for joining us as well, Taylor.
Good morning.
Good morning. Listeners, you can join this conversation by calling us up at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Or you can post your comments and questions at sltrib.com. Bethany Rogers, the legislative session, that is, starts on Monday. In the run-up to the session, we've been hearing about bill proposals, and we've seen some bills filed. One of those would make Utah abortion laws stricter. So who's running this bill, and what exactly would it do?
Representative Cheryl Acton is running this bill. The bill is pretty simple. It's only a few lines long. Essentially, it would just ban virtually all abortions after 15 weeks of gestation. There are some limited exceptions to that, but that's essentially all the bill would do.
Virtually all abortions. Can you talk about those exceptions, and then we'll dig a little bit deeper into response to that?
Sure. The exceptions would be in cases where the life of the mother is at risk, if there is a fatal flaw found with the fetus, or in cases of rape or incest.
Okay. This proposal, or a proposal very similar to it, has been tried elsewhere, but it has run into problems in the courts, right, Bethany?
That's right. Yeah. Last year, Mississippi passed a very similar proposal to this, and it was almost immediately challenged by the state's only abortion provider. In the federal courts later last year, a federal judge did find it unconstitutional, and the case is now on appeal.
What does Representative Representative Cheryl Acton, who's running this bill, what does she say to the likely court challenges that would come if this bill were to pass?
She says that it's not a sure thing that this bill will be challenged in court, although she acknowledges that that's the probability. But she says even if it is challenged in court, that it's a battle worth fighting, no matter the expense to taxpayers. She believes that this is something that states should be able to decide for themselves. And she believes that since Utah is a more conservative state, that it should be able to set its own abortion policies, and that the federal government should not be able to dictate to Utah, you know, what rules it should play and restrictions it should place on abortion.
Is the idea here maybe to try and force a court challenge, and that you know, eventually makes its way to the Supreme Court, and Utah becomes part of, you know, the momentum to overturn Roe v. Wade?
She said that her ideal situation would be that the bill does not end up in court, that it's just allowed to stand. However, she does see that there is, you know, several of these cases making their way through the court across the country. And she said that perhaps if enough states join in, that maybe the Supreme Court would recognize that states are clamoring for this ability.
Representative Acton says that she was asked to run this bill, right? Who asked her to run it?
So Pro-Life Utah was one of the groups that asked her, and she said the Utah Eagle Forum was the other. She said that she has always been anti-abortion for herself personally, but she's never really wanted to get into the political debate just because of how divisive it can be. However, she said when she was asked to run the bill, she researched this issue, she looked into abortions after 15 weeks, and she was personally convinced that this was something that she needed to get on board with.
This is obviously a very contentious issue, and I imagine that this proposal is getting flack from abortion rights advocates. Can you talk about what they say about this legislation, Bethany?
The main objection that I've heard so far is just that it's unconstitutional, and that is something that has been confirmed even by the legislative attorneys for the Utah legislature. They've taken a look at it, and they've said, yeah, this has a high probability of being overturned by a judge and being found unconstitutional. So a very large concern, I think, is just that this will not stand a legal test, and in the process, will be a waste of taxpayer dollars to defend, that this is a federal issue. It really belongs at the federal level. The states really shouldn't wade into this territory. But also there is the argument that the states should not get involved in abortion issues before the point of viability and, you know, get involved in telling a woman what she should do.
Okay. Jennifer Napier-Pierce, Salt Lake Tribune editor. In years past, a bill like this would have gotten a constitutional note, which is a note that was put on bills that strayed into territory regulated at the federal level, and in this case, that you know, has already been tested in the courts and other places. But the courts might be different now, and I think that you know, especially if you look at the Supreme Court, the question that we have to look at is, do we want to be the test case? Does the state of Utah want to spend tax dollars defending what is likely currently, at least, an unconstitutional measure? And maybe I pose that question to you as a member of the Tribune's editorial board. Is that something that the state of Utah should be engaged in?
Absolutely not. It's ridiculous that we are even talking about this right now. I mean, we editorialized, look, if you really are opposed to abortions, if you want the number of abortions in the state of Utah to decline, you need to look at comprehensive sex education first. And that's exactly where the Board of Education is directed. The numbers of abortions in Utah are declining. So a legal battle like this is futility, especially when you have a state like Missouri who's already in line. You know, if they want to make a statement, and I think this was Robert Gerke who elaborated on this in his column. Look, if you want to chime in on the debate, file an amicus brief with the Missouri case. It's going to the Supreme Court anyway. You might, if you want to be part of that test case, go that route. Don't spend $2 million of dollars of Utah taxpayer money on an exercise in futility. It's just bizarro.
You know, that point that abortions have been declining in the state of Utah is something that, Bethany, you reported on as well. Mm-hmm. What does that trend look like? I mean, how who measures it? Because the population of the state has been increasing. Is the number by number, not by percent, of abortions going down in the state of Utah?
Yes, the actual number of abortions is going down. That's data that's released every year by the Utah Department of Health, and it shows a decline even despite the population increase and despite increase in birth rates.
How central of an issue, maybe Jen, this might be going back to you, how central of an issue is abortion in Utah nationally? I was looking at a Pew opinion poll just before we came on air, and currently 58% of Americans say abortion should be legal in all or most cases, while 37% say it should be illegal, that is, in all or most cases. And I'm sure there are different breakdowns by state, but behind that question is whether, you know, I guess state lawmakers want to pass something like this. You know, is there a public mandate from Utah to try?
Well, you know, I think the Utah legislature has always skewed conservative, so the lawmakers may not accurately reflect the opinions of the broader populace. I will say that Roe v. Wade has been the law of the land for 45 years. Many, many people consider it settled law. I do think that the anti-abortion groups are feeling emboldened by Justice Kavanaugh being appointed. They think there might be some sway on the highest court of the land. I guess we'll see. That certainly was a fear when people were debating whether or not he should be appointed. And so, you know, I do think that there's some renewed confidence there from activists. But the general population, again, the numbers are declining, and it's because people are more educated about sex and how to prevent unwanted pregnancies. And that's a good thing.
A reminder to listeners that you can join this conversation by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. We welcome your opinions and questions. And here's a comment by Richard at sltrip.com. It reads, well, I guess we can keep the lawyers employed at taxpayer expense, touching on the idea that this will be challenged in the courts. Bethany, it's probably too early to tell this, but in terms of support in the legislature for a measure like Representative Acton's, do we have a sense of how lawmakers are feeling about it? Do we know?
Not broadly. A few of her conservative colleagues have spoken up and, you know, expressed some support for it. I will say that Governor Gary Herbert was asked about this at his you know, monthly news briefing yesterday. And he said that, you know, lawmakers will have to consider carefully if this is a battle that they want to fight and spend all of this money on. So it seems like even in his mind, it's debatable whether this is a good idea.
And he held off on saying whether or not he might veto it,
yes,
should it make its way to his desk. There is reportedly another proposal in the works for this year's meeting of lawmakers having to do with abortion. It's one that we actually saw last year by Representative Carrie-Anne Lisenby. And I'll just sum up the idea behind this one. It's to outlaw abortions in cases where a woman is terminating the pregnancy because she learns the fetus has Down syndrome. Other states have tried and failed with this one as well. And it's one that last year did get the that dreaded constitutional note that we don't have anymore. Jennifer Napier-Pierce, you know, before we head to a break, any comments on just the idea of, first off, getting rid of the constitutional note from the state legislature, and then also on Representative Lisenby's bill?
Well, the constitutional note, it's pretty clear that lawmakers don't want advice that they don't agree with. that's not a good way to make policy. You should have an open mind when you're considering all facets of a bill. So I think that's very short-sighted. I'm hoping that our lawmakers will come to an agreement that this kind of analysis is helpful. It helps not just them, but the public understand the implications of the laws that they're about to pass. So I would strongly encourage our lawmakers to reconsider that. In terms of Representative Lisenby's bill, you know, I just think that, again, we're talking about messing with law that's been established for 45 years. I do think that these are delicate situations that need to be carefully adjudicated and considered between a woman, her family, clergy, and her doctor. Why is the state of Utah imposing itself in those kind of sacred spaces? I'm not quite sure. So it didn't get anywhere last time. We'll see how far it gets this time.
And we will. The legislative session starts on Monday, and we're going to stick actually with some stories related to the legislative session after we take a quick break here on the show. This is Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in just a minute.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune editor Jennifer Napier-Pierce and reporters Bethany Rogers and Taylor Stevens. You can join us with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255. Or post them at the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com. Well, we left off previewing a couple of bills that will be at the legislative session, both of them relating to abortion. One of those was a bill that we've already seen once before, which isn't, it turns out, all that unusual. Bethany Rogers, you wrote this week about bills that keep coming back. They've been called boomerang bills. Can you give us some examples of what we're talking about with these boomerang bills? What's some of the legislation we will probably see this year that we have seen before?
We selected five of these boomerang bills and wrote about them. One of them relates to end of life and life-ending drugs, giving people the ability who have, you know, some terminal condition to end their lives. Another would be bills on hate crimes and on getting rid of daylight savings. So those are just a few
examples.
So
why is it that they keep coming back? I guess the obvious answer to that is that, you know, it's because they don't pass in their initial try. But why do lawmakers keep trying to run them?
Yeah, it seems like it kind of separates into two categories. And one would be that sometimes bills take a long time to get through and there is incremental progress year over year. And we kind of saw that, for example, with the medical cannabis debate, where this issue just kind of kept coming up and coming up and coming up. And then eventually, you know, there was a citizen initiative that kind of forced the legislature's hand. But it took a while for that momentum to build. So it seems like some lawmakers feel like if they just keep coming back and hammering away, that eventually they'll get there. Other lawmakers, it seems like, just want to get the discussion started or just want to keep it going. They feel like, you know, if I don't introduce this bill, then the conversation isn't even happening and education isn't even happening.
So there's a strategy there in trying to sort of move the needle on the opinion of the lawmakers, maybe by having them have to confront whatever the topic is year after year. Are these bills that are generally popular with the public when we're talking about bills that are returning?
Some of them are. I would say the hands-free phones bill is generally very popular among the public. And I know polling has shown here in Utah that getting rid of the time change is also very popular. So I think those are two where people would be generally on board.
And just to clarify, hands-free cell phones, this is a case in which you would only be allowed to speak on the phone while operating a vehicle if you had a hands-free device. You couldn't be holding a phone.
Yeah, it would be made a primary offense to be holding a phone and talking on it while driving. Hmm.
Jennifer Napier-Pierce, do you want to weigh in on any of these? In some instances, they seem, you know, as Bethany pointed out, popular with the public, but not necessarily with lawmakers, and that is not exactly an unusual disconnect there, the as we saw with Proposition 2, that there may be popular support for an initiative but not have the buy-in of the state lawmakers.
I think it's an interesting comment on our society just broadly. Look, you know, the deliberative process is an intentionally slow process. We are supposed to take our time and make sure that we are creating policies that don't have some loose ends, that, you know, maybe a concept that is ahead of its time. It's worth 2 or 3 years talking about it and making sure that this does reflect the sentiment of the people. It's constitutional, blah, blah, blah. So I think it's kind of funny that people are like, oh, gosh, it took 5 years. Well, I guess in our instant gratification society, we want kind of a quick turn legislative process, but that's really not the way the system is set up. I love that lawmakers are willing to initiate debates and introduce some concepts that they're hearing from their constituents. This end-of-life bill, that's right, been going on for a while. And now we've got a new representative who's taking up the torch from a previous representative who really pushed that. I think that kind of continuity is good, and I think it's good to have these important conversations that really do affect people's lives. These are lives at stake here.
Yeah. There's another one. I mean, so you mentioned the end-of-life bill, which is essentially compassionate end of life. I can't think of the phrase that is commonly associated with that, but another one.
Death with dignity, I think.
Thank you. There's another that keeps coming back, which is hate crimes legislation. A sticking point on that has been considered, or people have looked at the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints not, or in some cases, sort of passively opposing the bill. This year, they say that they're not going to oppose strengthening hate crimes legislation in Utah. And again, this is a question for Jennifer. How important is that in terms of the lawmaking process in the state of Utah?
Well, as Bethany pointed out, the church's lobbyist, Marty Stevens, who is a former House Speaker here in the state, he basically said, we're damned if we do and we're damned if we don't. He's a church leader, so he doesn't say that. But you know, if they weigh in on something, the church gets criticized. If they don't weigh in on something, they get criticized, which I think is a fair it's fair comment. But, you know, like it or not, they are the heavy hitter in town. They are the 900-pound gorilla. As an analysis by one of our reporters, Lee Davidson, showed 88% of the state legislature are active members of the LDS Church. And so when the church speaks, it does have this effect. I mean, it does ripple, and the fact that they're saying they're not going to oppose including LGBT in a hate crimes bill, I mean, I think that's pretty huge.
You know, I have to just bring up the fact that, you know, you brought up the article by Lee Davidson looking at the analysis of the makeup of the state legislature with the statistical, you know, makeup of state lawmakers, and 88% being, or 80 whatever percent being, mm-hmm, members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. There has been some blow up online on Twitter, for example, over that reporting. And I'm wondering, Jennifer, just as you know, as the editor of the paper, can you address the need to, or the reasons behind pointing out the fact, or you know, doing the analysis that shows that the vast majority of state lawmakers are members of the church.
Aren't you curious? Aren't you curious demographically, the slice of life that is represented at the state capitol for 45 days? I am, as a reader and as a citizen. I think it's totally legit to look at that kind of data. And that doesn't mean that everybody's going to vote lockstep with their faith. On the other hand, does it influence, does it color the way they see the world? Absolutely. And I think that's a fair story to throw out there. It certainly has generated some conversation, which as the editor, I'm thrilled with, because that's what our story should be doing, provoking, prodding, helping people to explore new ideas. I think that's a good thing.
All right. We were talking about boomerang bills that keep coming back around, and we'll see if any of them make it through this year, and they may come back again. We'll just wait and see. But in the meantime, we've spent the whole show so far talking about the state legislature. I think we should turn now to some news that isn't related to that and bring in Taylor Stevens, reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune, who has been waiting patiently. And Taylor, you reported this week on an update related to homeless shelters in Salt Lake City or in the Salt Lake City area. And just tell us the update. What's the update on what's happening with homeless shelters and their construction in Salt Lake City?
Yeah, so as we know and have talked about before, there is a plan to close the Road Home and open three smaller resource centers that are kind of dispersed around the county. And what the update that we're getting now is that construction is a little bit behind on the South Salt Lake Shelter Resource Center, and that's going to impact the closure date of the Road Home, which was originally scheduled to close in the summer. It's now looking like that is going to be mid-September. Lawmakers also just wanted to kind of give an update, and lawmakers and people who are involved in this effort, the Homeless Steering Committee, that's advocates, community organizers as well. But, you know, they're starting to kind of kick into gear. What is this transition going to look like? How are people experiencing homelessness going to find the services they need in this change? How are we going to make sure that this happens smoothly? And so, you know, I think that they see opportunities, but there's also definitely going to be some challenges in this new approach to homelessness in Salt Lake County.
Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox talked about how the move from the, you know, the central homeless shelter to these homeless resource centers marks a shift in strategy and how we're tackling homelessness. And I'm just wondering, you know, how is that marking a shift? Can you address that?
Yeah. So the Road Home is one of the largest homeless shelters in the country. And so by dispersing these populations, I think that first of all, they're hoping to kind of get, you know, a little bit smaller of a group, first of all, that they can know better possibly and provide really dedicated resources, kind of a one-stop shop for everything that someone experiencing homelessness might need. So that's food, shelter, water, employment opportunities, housing opportunities, all kind of in one localized, centralized place. We know from state audits that the Road Home has struggled in the past with open drug use, lawlessness. And so I think that they kind of want to disperse that out as well. There are people who do not want to stay at the Road Home because of the drug use that happens there. So that's kind of, you know, number one. And I think number two is just having all of these resources in one spot.
I just want to circle back actually for a second to the closure of the Road Home. You mentioned that it's being delayed. Part of that has to do with construction hiccups in South Salt Lake for the shelter that they're building there. Isn't there a state mandated deadline for the closure of the Road Home? And how? Can they actually just move that? Is moving that deadline a problem at all?
You know what they kind of, you know, walk that back a little bit and say that that's included in the legislative intent, but not in the law itself. And so, you know, they're saying we're pretty close, we're almost on deadline, and it's not in the law, so everything's good here.
And then as far as the delay goes in the construction of the South Salt Lake shelter, one person you spoke with in your article pointed to a little bit of reticence on the part of South Salt Lake a fair amount of reticence on the part of South Salt Lake to accept that shelter initially. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's no secret that location choice for these three homeless resource centers has been contentious. What they talk about is, yes, there has been, you know, they're not exactly thrilled about this coming to South Salt Lake. There has been some challenges getting all of the necessary kind of ducks in a row for this, but they said South Salt Lake has become a better partner over the months with this. So, you know, we'll see how the reaction is once these actually come online too.
You know, I wonder though, do we know very well the population we're trying to serve? There was an audit recently showing that what we don't know about homelessness in Utah is a lot. Can you talk about that audit and how lawmakers, I mean, who are planning this new strategy to address homelessness that centers around these three new homeless resource centers and not the central shelter, where they're starting from? Like, how are they thinking about the data that they don't have? And I mean, are they mm-hmm. are they trying to gather that data now? What are they doing?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, that audit, which basically said that the data was inconsistent, riddled with errors, that they don't have good information about, you know, where things are at now. And so I think it's going to be tough for lawmakers, community advocates to really gauge how successful this new effort is, because we don't really have a benchmark of how successful the old road home kind of strategy was. So that's going to be a challenge. But the state says there are efforts underway to improve that data. And so they're going to be kind of monitoring the program outcomes. So we'll see how that goes. But that's one, you know, challenge that advocates have mentioned. You know, how do we know we haven't put all of this time, money, and resources into an effort that's going to leave people experiencing homelessness worse off?
Again, 801-355-8255 to join this conversation. Jennifer Napier-Pierce, Salt Lake Tribune editor. You know, in thinking about what we don't know, one thing that I do know is that there's been an influx in the number of homeless people here on Library Square since Operation Rio Grande went into effect. And the thing about this audit that Taylor's mentioning is that, you know, we don't know. I don't know if we're making progress. Does anyone know if we're making progress on homelessness in the state of Utah?
So they say. I mean, again, there are a lot of variables that have to check before we'll actually know the answer to that question. But open your eyes, people. Look downtown. There's a homeless guy who lives in the school, you know, playground next to my house. I just the population has dispersed into places where it has not been visible. So to me, I have a lot of questions about whether or not this new approach will work. And it's a shame that the new shelter is delayed. I don't know if it's going to work, to be honest. I mean, we had a group of people come in who are decision makers, key stakeholders, and, you know, they presented one part of this story. But then word on the street is that the shelter right now is beyond overflowing. People are sleeping on the floor. So, you know, I don't know what to believe, because...
And we're shrinking the number of beds in the end, also with the opening
yes.
of these new shelters.
I mean, yes. There'll be 400 fewer beds when it's all said and done.
That's right.
I mean, we're looking at this from, you know, somebody has to do something, right? And this is what lawmakers and what state leaders are trying to do. But I wonder if maybe, and Jennifer, this is obviously a question for an editorial voice, if there's too much faith in putting into these buildings as opposed to whatever the other strategy might be. And I don't have the answer, of course.
Well, I mean, there's the treatment bed component. There's the mental health assistance component. There's the low-income housing that absolutely needs to kick in as part of this holistic solution. But again, I mean, there's a lot of moving parts right here. And I don't know that this model is going to succeed without sustained support from the state. I mean, I think that the state's leadership in this movement has been key, but it can't be like, oh, we finished a building, everything's solved. You know, that's not the way these long-term chronic problems are solved.
Taylor Stevens, how about the funding aspect of this? Where is the money coming from to fund the not just the construction of the new shelters, but the ongoing operations of those shelters? Do you have a sense on that?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I know that there is some state funding elements of it, but Yeah. We'll see.
And then you also spoke with an advocate for the homeless. This is Bernie Hart, who is a familiar face around here on Library Square. And he has concerns about the, I mean, this is probably who you were speaking of, but about that lack of data and not knowing what our starting point is, essentially.
Yeah. And he's also worried, you know, about trauma for people experiencing homelessness, that this is going to make the population harder to serve for a while, kind of this forced relocation element. And, you know, he also raised concerns, like Jennifer was talking about earlier, that this will further disperse populations and make it harder for people who are experiencing homelessness to find the resources that they need.
Okay.
It's not an easy problem to solve. I mean, I don't want to cast aspersions on the good intentions that are behind this, but we don't know if it's going to work until, you know, it happens. And I think, you know, having all of these facilities online, will it divert people who need specific help, who are there in a very, 30-day transition kind of bind? Will it get them the help that they need and lower the overall numbers of people living on the street? Or, what percentage of this population is not going to go to a center and get, you know, access the services that are available? So I just think that there are so many moving parts right now. I'm optimistic. I want this to succeed, but I don't have any indication that it is right now. I mean, I really don't. At least the homeless people that my reporters are talking to, they don't have tremendous confidence in the success here. But again, it's a vulnerable population, and things can certainly change.
And a complex population.
Absolutely.
And a diverse population, and one that isn't easily put into one category. I mean, you talked about the people who are suffering maybe temporary homelessness who will be helped by getting immediate job resources. But then there are people who have life problems that prevent them from being able to jump into that next thing.
Yeah, yeah. And, I don't think it helps that, generally, people don't want to see the homeless. It makes them feel bad. They don't know why people are out on the streets. And so there's sort of that stigma that these centers are not going to solve. You know, I just don't think that overnight people are going to be like, oh, all of a sudden, everybody has a place in society. It's much more complex.
And I think the Homeless Steering Committee is anticipating that it will need to make tweaks. You know, I think that the stakeholders understand this is kind of step one in a larger strategy, and that there are going to be, you know, challenges and opportunities that we don't know right now that maybe we'll identify once these new shelters come online.
When you remind us just the sort of time frame of that, we have a delay for the South Salt Lake.
The other two are scheduled to open on time in July, June, in kind of in that area of the summer. And
one's
then,
for women.
Yep.
And the other's for men and women.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then there's the family shelter in Midvale.
Right. Right. And so then the Road Home will kind of slowly start decreasing its population and close completely in September. So I think that actually might be a good way to transition it rather than just a drop dead date. So we'll see.
Well, and a point definitely to start measuring effectiveness as well. We need to take another break here on the show, and when we come back, we'll squeeze in one more story and then turn to our underplayed stories of the week. And still ahead, a Sundance Film Festival preview. I'm Roger McDonough. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I am joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Jennifer Napier-Pierce, Bethany Rogers, and Taylor Stevens. This is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. I said I was going to try and squeeze in one additional story before we head to our underplayed stories. Taylor, this is a story about the Salt Lake City Council having a new member, and I'm going to ask you to quickly give us the recap of how that came to be.
Yeah, District 4 has not had a council person since Senator Derek Kitchen left the council to serve in the legislature. The council had 22 initially candidates for this, interviewed 18 in a public meeting, and chose Analia Valdemoros, who is an immigrant, a business owner. She's worked for the Planning Commission in Salt Lake City, so she has experience in both the private and the public sector. And one of the things that she talked about is, you know, Salt Lake City Council talks a lot about diversity and how to increase the diversity of representation on the body. And she kind of brings some unique perspectives, being a Latina, Hispanic, and being an immigrant. And so it's kind of a shift for the city council to have that there.
All right. And Argentina-born businesswoman, she is co-owner of Spice Kitchen. She also has an empanada shop around the corner here called Argentina's Best Empanadas.
Yum.
Yum. Thanks for the empanadas. All right. Just to save time for a recorded – thanks for that, Taylor, by the way. Thanks to everyone here for your reporting. But to save time for a recorded Sundance Film Festival preview, we are going to turn right now to our underplayed stories of the week. And Jennifer Napier-Pierce, do you want to kick us off?
Have you been to Fayette?
No.
Utah? Okay. It's a tiny town in San Pete County, 250 residents. Well, we found out this week that the town clerk had been embezzling money from this tiny little town of 250 residents to the tune of $300,000 over 9 years. And so she was, she pleaded guilty to felony counts. It's a great story. Just to show, gosh darn it, crime can happen everywhere. Yeah. And Lee Davidson points it out in a story at sltrib.com.
Yeah, and the amount of money that is I mean, the percentage of the town budget.
I know.
It was pretty incredible. All right. Bethany Rogers, your pick for underplayed story.
Yes. Earlier this week, we heard about how there's a growing call to name the Gila monster the Lizard of Utah. There's actually a piece of legislation that's going to be considered this session to that effect. And apparently it all started with a group of intermediate school students.
I disagree with that. I've never seen a Gila monster, but I see lots of other lizards anyway.
I'm going for bobcat. All right. Taylor Stevens, your pick for underplayed story.
Yeah, there's a great story from my colleague Scott Pierce about Ted Bundy, and there is going to be a Sundance documentary on Ted Bundy, an infamous serial killer in Utah. A lot of interesting history in there ahead of that documentary. Give it a read.
Yeah, it's an interesting read, and I mean, difficult, but fascinating. Okay, that's Taylor Stevens' pick. For my pick, I'm going to do, this is hardly underplayed at all, but we didn't tackle this story about a proposal by Grantsville Republican Representative Merrill Nelson to block Utahns from changing the sex listed on their birth certificates and leave only two designations, male or female, on that birth certificate. That has transgender Utahns and their allies up in arms. Maybe the underplayed part of this is that Governor Gary Herbert, in his monthly televised news conference yesterday, said that people who want to change their gender on public documents should have a process to do it. Courtney Tanner wrote about this. Robert Gerke has a column. Give them a read at sltrib.com. Jennifer Napier-Pierce, Bethany Rogers, and Taylor Stevens, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
For the remainder of the show, we will turn to a conversation with Salt Lake Tribune movie critic Sean P. Means, who I spoke with yesterday for a preview of this year's Sundance Film Festival, which kicked off yesterday. Sean, here we are in the Egyptian Theater on Main Street in historic Park City. It's the 2019 Sundance Film Festival is just about to get underway. What are you looking forward to at this year's festival?
Well, it's hard to say sometimes, because I've learned over the years that looking forward to things is almost a mistake, because the best things you find are the ones that you didn't expect. I mean, the example I give that just blew me away was 2012. There was this movie with a weird title. It was with nobody in it, filmed regionally in Louisiana, with the lead actress being a 7-year-old girl with a name you couldn't pronounce. That turned out to be Beasts of the Southern Wild with Quvenzhané Wallace, and we all learned how to pronounce it. And that's one of the best movies I've seen here in the last 10-20 years. And
you weren't going into that festival thinking this is the one I'm going
to.
No, you know.
Matter of fact, I went. I didn't plan to go to the first screening, which is one of the things I tend to do if it's something with big stars and you know there's a lot of buzz around and so on. But I had it down further in the list. But then after the first screening, the second screening, I kept hearing standing ovations and everybody just loved it. And then I finally did see it and it, more standing ovations and it was completely deserved. It's a wonderful movie. Went on to get Oscar nominations, nominated for Best Picture. So you really never can tell. The ones that will sneak up on you tend to be the ones that you remember years later.
All right, well, let's talk about some of the films that do have buzz that, mm-hmm. You know, may not be those sleepers that you're expecting. But, you know, what's the big star power draw this year from your perspective?
Weirdly enough, the biggest star, the big star that's coming is the biggest star in Hollywood, which is Dwayne Johnson, who belongs here, you know, about as much as a surfboard competition. But he is produced and he's co-starring as himself in a movie that got put in as a last-minute entry as a surprise screening called Fighting With My Family. And it's a comedy, a real-life story about an English family who did the pro wrestling as sort of a little circuit in the UK. And the two kids, the younger ones, got an audition with the WWE. And this is actually based on the real story of Paige, who is one of the WWE superstars. And it's about how she came up from nothing. And Dwayne Johnson appears as himself, because who else would or could? And so that's, I mean, seriously, the biggest star in Hollywood, and he's going to be here, which is, it shows something about how even Hollywood pays attention to the indie world sometimes.
Right.
So, but really, the other, I mean, you're talking about a big star, somebody whose name is on everybody's lips. It's not a movie star. It's not an actor. It's Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the congresswoman from New York. Right. She's here in a documentary called Knock Down the House, which started out with the filmmakers looking at four insurgent Democratic candidates who tried to primary out establishment Democrats. She's the one of the four that actually made it, actually won, and won the primary and got in, and now is in the Congress. You know, that's one of those instances where the documentarian is, you know, it's always better to be lucky than good. With a documentary filmmaker, you go into it sometimes, you don't know where it's going to go. This one went where we now have, you know, one of the most talked about and most media savvy Congress people that has ever come around.
Rising star,
and she's going to be here. And everybody, and that is going to be, I mean, everything's a sold out show here, but that's going to be a very hot ticket.
The documentaries in general are something that I like to look at because I don't know how many of the past Oscar winners debuted at Sundance, but it's a kind of high, in the past few years, it's a pretty high number.
Of the documentary feature nominees that were announced on Tuesday, four of the five opened here last year at Sundance, including RBG, including Minding the Gap, which is a great movie, The Fathers and Sons, and I'm blanking on the fourth one.
That's all right. How about other documentaries that are showing up this year? So the Ocasio-Cortez is got a lot of buzz, but kind of the opposite spectrum of that is a documentary about Steve Bannon.
Well, The Brink, and I asked the publicist, and Steve Bannon will not be appearing in Sundance for this one. He has been at Sundance because he used to produce movies before he got into the politics thing. But he apparently doesn't like this movie, unlike other movies that have been made about him. But the documentaries this year, it used to say it was the biggest secret at Sundance was that the documentaries were the best movies. It's not a secret anymore. Everybody knows, you know, you get movies that are going to be great. Some interesting ones, I think, this year. The documentary premieres frequently are personality-driven. They're like profiles of interesting people or famous people. And this year, you've got some good ones. You've got Ask Dr. Ruth about Ruth Westheimer,
right.
90 years old, still going strong. Raise Hell, The Life and Times of Molly Ivins, about the great Texas political columnist and rabble-rouser. There's one on Miles Davis. There's one on Toni Morrison. The other one is Alex Gibney did this documentary about Elizabeth Holmes, the inventor and creator of Theranos, the supposed super fast blood test that was going to revolutionize the world. Well, it turned out to be a fraud. That's what the documentary is about. It's called The Inventor Out for Blood in Silicon Valley. And Alex Gibney has been here before, did Taxi to the Dark Side, did Lance Armstrong, and you know, he's a documentary machine. So, and you know, he got his first movie here was the movie Enron, The Smartest Guys in the Room, which was one of the best exposés ever.
Yeah.
So it should be interesting.
How about, I don't have too much time, so I want to jump around to maybe some features, either World Dramatic Competition or what's, you know, being produced here in the United States. That again, it has that element of there being something that's a sleeper that you never expect to show up, but What are you liking so far? What are you thinking? Well, you don't know. You haven't seen any movies yet, right?
Yeah, I haven't seen any of the feature films yet. The ones I'm looking forward to, there's one called The Farewell, which is a comedy drama about a Chinese-American woman who goes back to China because the grandmother is dying, and they're trying to not let her know that. this one is the lead actress is Awkwafina, the comedian rapper who was in Crazy Rich Asians and Ocean's 8, and this is maybe her big starring role. So that one is a lot of people looking forward to. I think it's going to be really interesting. There's Hala, which is about a Muslim American teen girl trying to sort of find her way in the world. Elements of comedy and drama. And a lead actress, Geraldine Viswanathan, who is very funny. She was in the movie Blockers. She was John Cena's daughter in that movie. And in both of these instances, people who are, you notice the directors in these stories, not white males. And that's something that the Sundance has been very big about this year is, they've always been a haven for diverse voices and underrepresented voices, women, people of color, LGBT, and so on. And they're really putting their money where their mouth is with it this year. They even get the data and the statistics to sort of back up the diversity that Sundance brings that the rest of Hollywood needs.
I was going to say that most of Hollywood doesn't have, including among the feature films nominated for Best Picture this year and so on and so forth. Why does Sundance do it better?
It's very organic, and they are looking for stories that they have not heard before. And when you're dealing with Hollywood, that is, where 75% of the executives are white men, where the vast majority of the directors are white men, the stories you're not going to hear before in the indie world are going to be the stories by women, by people of color, by LGBTQ people. So it does become organic that those voices, those underrepresented voices, bubble up to the surface at Sundance. I mean, you're going to get the white boy coming of age movie. Looks to be a very funny one called Big Time Adolescence with Pete Davidson from Saturday Night Live and formerly Ariana Grande's boyfriend, and which that red carpet's going to be a zoo. You get the diversity because they see the stuff that comes in, and they want to hear the things that they haven't heard before, and that's where those come from.
And is part of that, a different business model? You're not looking for the sales, for the massive money making.
The programmers at Sundance are not picking these movies based on, is it going to sell in China? Is it going to sell in sell out a weekend in June up against the Avengers or something? That's not what the programmers look at. They don't think about the money aspect of it. Now there are the people who are. A lot of people who come to the festival are those people who make those decisions, who buy the films that will go to, Fox Searchlight or Netflix or Amazon or, A24 or any of the distributors. They will look at the films and they will do the calculation of, okay, will it sell in China? Will it be a good counterpoint to, the next Pixar movie? That's where the deal making happens.
Well, and Netflix is a big player now here at Sundance. I mean, there you have films that go straight from Sundance into Netflix, and sometimes even sooner than that.
There's actually a movie premiering here called Velvet Buzzsaw. The guy that did Nightcrawler directed it, with Jake Gyllenhaal and Rene Russo. A horror movie that's also a sort of a satire of the art world. It's premiering on the 27th. It will be on Netflix on the 1st, which is even before two screenings of it here at the festival. Boy Who Harnessed the Wind will be in Netflix in February or March. There are others. Netflix is a big player, both in terms of they bankroll movies that get here and then will appear on the service soon after, and they take advantage of Sundance to generate the buzz so that people will be excited when the movies show up on Netflix a month later. And they'll buy stuff that they will then pop up on Netflix later. And then the calculus becomes for the filmmakers and is having the potential of a lot of eyeballs on Netflix worth the not having the thing about being in theaters?
Right.
Or can you talk them into doing, the Netflix will do something in theaters the way they did for Roma and Ballad of Buster Scruggs.
Yeah.
But not everybody's the Coen brothers, or Alfonso Cuarón. So you run that risk because, some people have said Netflix is the place where indie movies go to die because they'll have a big splash at Sundance, they'll show up on Netflix, and then nobody remembers them 6 months later.
Hey, any, you know, final movie you want to highlight? Maybe worth checking out now or when it, you know, potentially gets released somewhere else?
The one that I think is going to be most interesting in this particular audience, and it may play differently here than it will play anywhere else in the world, is there's a documentary called Untouchable, which is an expose about Harvey Weinstein and how he used his power to keep stories about his unsavory behaviors, you know, sexual harassment, sexual assault, out of the papers and avoiding any sort of, you know, consequence. At least three cases of the women he assaulted or harassed happened during this festival, during Sundance, in Park City hotels. And there are a lot of people here who at one point or another relied on Harvey for some part of their livelihood. And now everybody's turned on him because, you know, it reached a critical mass of where what he did to people was too much to ignore or too much to look aside, as it was for many years. So there's a lot of people here who may have a little bit of guilt over that, over being part of that machine. And it'll
or
be inter-
of looking, or of looking the other way.
Or looking the other way. And it'd be interesting to see how the reaction when that movie plays here at the festival.
At Sundance. Mm-hmm. Sean P. Means, Salt Lake Tribune movie guy, thanks very much for taking the time to talk with me today.
Happy to do it. Thanks.
That's Salt Lake Tribune movie critic Sean P. Means, who I spoke with yesterday at the Egyptian Theater on Main Street in Park City at the kickoff of the 2019 Sundance Film Festival. You can follow his coverage of Sundance at sltrib.com. Behind the Headlines is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune and is heard across the state on Utah Public Radio. Thanks very much to Jesse Ellis here at KCPW and to the team at Utah Public Radio in Logan for their help. You can find podcasts of this and all of our local programs at our website, kcpw.org, or through your podcast app. And you can always catch up with KCPW on Facebook. We are KCPW 88.3, or on Twitter, where we are at KCPW. And on Twitter, I am at Roger McDonough. Excuse me about that. Coming up next on KCPW Presents, it's a Climate One special called We're Doomed, Now What? The premise of the show is that when we think about the enormity of climate change and what it's doing to our planet, it's easy to become overwhelmed. But maybe that's not such a bad place to be. Check it out coming up next on KCPW Presents. Thanks again for joining us for Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week.